He said, "Don't call everything a conspiracy like they do, and don't live in dread of what frightens them. Make the Lord of heaven's armies holy in your life. He is the one you should fear. He is the one who should make you tremble. He will keep you safe. But to Israel and Judah, he will be a stone that makes people stumble, a rock that makes them fall. And for the people of Jerusalem, he will be a trap and a snare. Many will stumble and fall, never to rise again. They will be snared and captured. Preserve the teaching of God and trust his instructions to those who follow me. I will wait for the Lord, who has turned away from the descendants of Jacob. I will put my hope in him."
Okay, just give me a moment as I just make some space up here. I'm also doing, let's see, this is going to test my skills today. Yes, okay. So I think one of the worst things we can experience in life sometimes is rejection. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands if you've ever felt rejected, because it can be something that maybe we don't always want to disclose. Especially because some forms of rejection have a way of like really sitting with us, and it can be a form of shame that I think sometimes we hold on to. So we might have like minor rejections, like, you know, when you're at school, maybe you weren't chosen to be on the sports team. Or when I was a teenager, I like tried to write, and I'm sure they're really terrible short stories, and then I'd send them to like magazines and get lots of rejection letters back, or I'd like be like, "Oh, I have this novel, maybe a publisher will like want to discover me already," when I'm like 13, and also I got rejected. So you can have those forms of rejection, and maybe sometimes there can be pride in that a little bit. Maybe you can have forms of rejection around work. So sometimes maybe you are expecting a promotion and it kind of seems to bypass you and somebody else gets it, and you might feel rejected, like, why wasn't I good enough? I was kind of expecting that. Or maybe you end up losing your job, you're made redundant, and that can be a form of rejection and maybe shame. So there's that type of stuff. But I actually think sometimes it's also the more relational, the more personal rejections that can kind of wound us more. So this week was Valentine's Day. I don't know if anyone did anything to celebrate, but Valentine's Day can be this like a painful time for some people. Or maybe you decided, "Oh, Valentine's Day is coming up, I'm going to ask somebody out." And when somebody turns you down, you can feel rejected, like, "Oh, why wasn't I good enough? Why did they say no?" Or if you are in a relationship for a long time, and that relationship breaks down, or if one partner suddenly is like, "Oh, I don't want to be in this relationship anymore," again, that can really wound people, and you can carry that wound for quite a while. So there's romantic relationships where we can experience forms of rejection, but it's not just romantic relationships. Even in our families, and often our families can be complex beasts, there can be spaces where actually the people who are closest to us, the people who should love us the most, can sometimes reject us, and we can feel like we're cast out or alone or adrift. So how do you process that form of rejection? Because really, the possibility is there. Whenever we are in a group of people, there's the possibility that we'll be rejected. So back in my summer holidays, which feels like a while ago now, I managed to finally go to the Van Gogh Digital Art Exhibition. I feel like it's been around for quite a few years, because I almost went to it a few years ago, but then COVID kind of happened. So I finally made it. Has anyone else visited it? Yeah, a few people. So I think Van Gogh's art is incredible, but I didn't fully appreciate like his story. So his life story is pretty interesting too, and his story is marked by rejection. So what I discovered, that actually when he was younger, he wanted to be a minister. He wanted to be a Calvinist pastor, part of the Dutch Reformed Church. And if you know anything about those words, it's quite a conservative church. But that's what his father was doing. So he's like, "Okay, I'm going to follow in the footsteps of my father." He was, you know, passionate for Jesus. But he had to sit an entrance exam
in order to start his theological training, and he failed. So that was his first kind of, I guess, sense of rejection. But at this stage, he's kind of not deterred. So instead, he becomes a missionary to this like little coal mining community in Belgium. So he's 25 years old. And he goes and lives in this mining village, and he kind of really throws himself into it. So he actually somehow manages to get down into the mines. So he spends time with the miners, and he can see how hard the work is being a miner. He can see there's a lot of poverty. He can see like how pale and haggard they are. And so it begins to change the way that he lives. So he starts to dress in rags. He starts to like sleep on straw and give away as much as he can. The miners love him. They actually nickname him Christ in the Mines. But the church is not so impressed. They're like, oh, this is a bit undignified, lying on straw. This is going to like ruin our reputation. They don't get what he is doing. And so they end up rejecting him. They expel him. They say, you can't be a missionary anymore. And I wonder at that moment if he felt like God was in a sense rejecting him, or if he could separate out the difference between church and God. And I wonder this because even though Vincent, you know, lived some time ago now, this is still a familiar story for people today. There's people who will testify to experiencing like they've been rejected from church. Like, you know, maybe they don't fit in, or they're a little bit different in some way, or maybe they push the boundary. And this community who says, we represent God, we are following Christ, suddenly says, you're not welcome. How do you process that when you are suddenly feeling like you're cast out and adrift and alone? Like, what do you do next? Well, actually, in the passage that we're looking at today, Isaiah 8, and we have this brief glimpse into a little bit of Isaiah's own personal story as well. Now, this is rare. We don't get many instances of this. Often, the messages that God is giving is like to the whole community. But in this chapter, we have a little glimpse of God actually talking to Isaiah, and we get to kind of like listen in. And part of what God's doing, particularly in the last, between Isaiah 6 to Isaiah 8, these last few chapters have been kind of preparing Isaiah for what it means to be a prophet. So a prophet is someone who speaks on behalf of God, and a prophet often experiences some form of rejection. So God is preparing Isaiah for that. But he also warns Isaiah that he might actually have to reject certain things that he sees around him as well. And so the passage that we're looking at begins like this. Isaiah 8 verse 11. Yahweh spoke thus to me while his hand was strong upon me and warned me not to walk in the way of this people, saying, do not call conspiracy all that this people calls conspiracy, and do not fear what it fears or be in dread. But Yahweh of hosts, him you shall regard as holy. Let him be your fear and let him be your dread. So Isaiah is called to reject certain lifestyles and patterns that he sees around him. And it's a strong warning that God gives. Isaiah describes that as like someone, a strong hand, like being placed on your shoulder, pressing down. And I think it has to be strong because what God is essentially saying is, don't go that way. But as people who want to belong and be accepted, we often want to just follow everybody else, right? Like our natural inclination is to conform to what we see around us. And so to actually go the opposite way is hard. And so I think this is why there's such strong language being used here. God is saying, I need you to be a counter voice. Because in this time, the people of God, they have kind of lost their way with God. As we saw last week, they're kind of in a little bit of a panic. There's all these like rumors of war and invasions. And when you're panicked and when you're full of dread, I think you're more likely just to like take whatever you hear, whatever conspiracy, whatever fear, whatever solution. You're just kind of like taking it all in, running around like, you know, a headless chook until you can't discern what is actually good and true anymore. And so part of the reason why God is raising up Isaiah is to be this counter voice. But in order to be a counter voice, you have to be a little bit different. And so God says, I need you to go in a different direction. If you remember back a few weeks ago, when Isaiah first received his calling to be a prophet, he had this like amazing vision of the throne room of God. And part of what God says to Isaiah then is he also says, chances are though, you're going to do all this and the people probably aren't going to really hear. Like, people's hearts are so hard at this point that you might not see any change. You might be rejected from your community. Nonetheless, this is what I'm calling you to do. Now, I don't think many of us are prophets like Isaiah. We live in a very different time. But I think we should expect that there might be times when we need to discern whether we adopt every lifestyle and practice that we see around us. And that's tricky to do. Like, how do you discern how to live? When do we conform? When do we go a different way? I think it requires listening to different voices. It requires humility. And it's trying to see what is good, what is loving, and what glorifies God. So we do that to a degree when we look around in our own society. But I also think there's times when we need to discern the lifestyles and patterns that we see in the church as well. Because Isaiah is talking to the people of God. And he's saying, even the people of God can get it wrong. Even the people of God can say, you know, we worship Yahweh, but in their lifestyles don't actually reflect God. And I think that's true of the church, right? That there are times when we look at the church, people who say, we follow Christ. And we're like, actually, your lifestyles and patterns aren't reflecting Christ. And so there's discernment. We need the help of the Spirit to try and figure out what does it mean to follow Christ. And that might mean sometimes being a counter voice. It might mean actually experiencing a form of rejection. But this motif of rejection is one that keeps coming up again and again in the scriptures. Like, you think about a lot of the people in our Bibles, like Isaiah, ultimately, like Jesus, and you think, rejection keeps coming up. God is trying to prepare us that this might be part of our story as well. You know, think of Jesus, we think Jesus did not conform to the expectations of his day. He healed people on the Sabbath, which seemed to upset a lot of people. He ate with people that others thought, oh, you shouldn't really associate with. And the religious leaders were often quite upset with him. And yet this is the model that Jesus kind of lived out and I think calls us into as well. Vincent van Gogh, after he was rejected by the church, so no longer a missionary, ends up staying in the coal town for a while. And I think it's partly because he's not in a good mental state. He's exhausted. He's distressed by what has happened. So he's in this town. I think he's like living in this like dark miner's hut. And he starts to really get into sketching and drawing. Like, he's done it before, but he really, really takes it up at this point. And he's sketching a lot of the miners that he sees. And starting to see God in them. And as he's sketching and drawing, he's changed. And so about a year later, he eventually returns back to his father's home. And he's like, I'm not going to be part of the institutional church anymore. He's quite critical of what he calls the hypocrisy of the church. And he's like, I'm going to forge a new path. I'm going to be a counter voice. And I'm going to go in a different direction. So out of this rejection kind of is birthed this ability to be a different voice. And so I think about rejection that we might experience, and sometimes I think some rejection can be like unhealthy, kind of just sits in us and we don't deal with it well. But there is, I think, a way that we can process rejection that actually can lead to something good. And Isaiah then goes and hints at a way forward when he starts to speak about how God has sustained him in his time of rejection. He says, Isaiah 8, verse 14, he'll become a sanctuary, a stone one strikes against. For both houses of Israel, he'll become a rock one stumbles over, a trap and a snare for the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And many among them shall stumble, they shall fall and be broken, they shall be snared and taken. Isaiah's promise that even though he might have to reject certain things, or even if he might experience rejection, no matter what, God's presence is with him. And it's described as being like a sanctuary. So God will be a safe place, a hope, a comfort to Isaiah, because God knows what it is to be rejected. And so God wants to reassure Isaiah, no matter what, you do not walk this alone. I am with you. And then he goes on to also say, while being like a comforting image, like a sanctuary, he also, it can be like a rock, like having a pebble in your shoe. And that is what he's kind of like to the rest of the community. Because I think he's trying to like get people's attention. So he's like, maybe if I'm a rock in their shoe, they will turn back to me and we can experience reconciliation. So God's presence is constant, but sometimes it might be encouraging and sometimes it might be challenging. God meets us where we're at. Vincent was rejected not only by the church and not only by his parents. He had not much success when it came to romance. He was rejected multiple times by multiple women. He painted and painted, but only ever sold, I think, one artwork in his life. He struggled with his mental health, so I wonder sometimes if it felt like, you know, his own mind or body was rejecting him. And yet, even though he experienced a lot of rejection and failure, he also speaks about what sustains him, and what he learned was to be attentive to the Spirit of God, particularly in the natural world. And so he'd often write, and you can see this in his paintings, about beauty and trying to find God in the beauty. And so speaking to his brother, Theo, he says this: "Yet if one has the need for something great, something infinite, something in which one can see God, one needn't look far. I thought I saw something deeper, more infinite, more eternal than an ocean in the expression in the eyes of a baby, when it wakes in the morning and crows or laughs because it sees the sun shine into its cradle. If there's a ray from on high, it might be found here." So Vincent van Gogh is, of course, known for his use of light and how he takes this posture of wonder. And I think that's why so many people resonate with his work, because the way that he paints kind of reminds us that the world is wonderful and that God is at work in the world. But he doesn't just do this with natural landscapes. He also paints people. And again, he's trying to, I think, teach us or remind us that God's Spirit is at work in all different types of people, but especially the people we might overlook. So in Vincent's day, that's like the coal miners and the ordinary and the poor. He tries to capture them as well. This becomes his sanctuary and his inspiration. And out of that comes a work that endures. Isaiah 8, verse 16. "Bind up this testimony of warning and seal up God's instruction among my disciples. I'll wait for Yahweh, who is hiding his face from the descendants of Jacob. I'll put my trust in him. Here am I and the children Yahweh has given me. We are signs and symbols in Israel from Yahweh Almighty, who dwells on Mount Zion." So Isaiah is prepared that his message probably won't be received in the short term. In the short term, it's going to be rejected, but he has this promise that in the long term, it will be received. Now, even though Isaiah knows that people aren't really going to be excited to hear his message, it doesn't seem to put him off. Like, he gives his all. He goes out there and he's constantly preaching the message that God has given him. And like a lot of the prophets, they often do like crazy stunts to make a point. So in the beginning of this chapter, Isaiah writes on this tablet, or maybe it's a scroll, and he writes, "Spoil speeds, pray hastens," and he gets like people to look at it, and he's trying to give a message, but it doesn't seem to catch on. And so when he has his next son, he actually names his son that, and this is a habit. We've already been told last chapter Isaiah 7, that presumably his first son is effectively named "A Remnant Shall Return." So his sons are kind of caught up into this public spectacle. Like, even his children are signs trying to convey God's message. Whenever Isaiah has an opportunity to talk to a king, so we saw last week he was talking to Ahaz, he would take it up. So he gives his all, but he's also told to make arrangements for this message to survive beyond his lifetime. And this is really, it's fascinating for scholars here, because this is a very rare occasion where we have a glimpse into the writing process, like how something becomes written down. Because prophets begin like kind of like preachers, just giving an oral communication. But at some point, someone, you know, takes the time to write it down. And so here we have this curious reference to disciples. So Isaiah has disciples, in other words, students. Some people like to call it the school of prophets, who are responsible, are going to take up the responsibility of ensuring that Isaiah's message is like written down and preserved. Some people might say that they might even contribute to the book of Isaiah, but we'll get into that further down the track.
But this is a pretty big responsibility because it's a dangerous time. War will come to the land, Jerusalem will be ruined, and you know, war is devastating for lots of reasons, but one of the reasons why war is so devastating is not just the loss of life, but the knowledge and culture that is lost in a city. You know, so many scrolls can be destroyed, so much artwork can be destroyed when a city is at war. So these disciples think that Isaiah's words are so valuable that they managed to preserve and transmit and keep it safe so that we have it now. And so we get to kind of reap the benefits of that. We see that even though Isaiah's message was rejected short term, long term, you know, the church now recognizes that these words are good, that these words are from God. I always find it a little bit fascinating, people who work in obscurity and then are like kind of celebrated and recognized as valuable after their death. And I'm always like, what keeps them going? And I think we've seen here like God can sustain us. Sometimes the love of what we're doing can sustain us. But also, you don't want to be totally alone. You need to have a few people who kind of believe or can see what you're doing. So Isaiah had his disciples. He also has a family. And Vincent van Gogh was sustained a lot by his brother. So Theo played an incredible role, like financially supporting him. And also he really believed in his work. So when Vincent tragically died, his brother Theo kind of took on the responsibility and said, I need to make this work known. Now, unfortunately, he too ends up dying like 6 months after Vincent. And so then the responsibility passes on to his widow. So his widow's name is Jo. She's 28 years old. She's only been married for 2 years. She has, I think, a 6-month-old baby, so quite a long, young child. And also at least 200 artworks of Vincent van Gogh's in her little apartment in Paris. And I think in order to remember her husband's memory, she kind of takes this on. And so she becomes this really savvy businesswoman, actually. She learns how to make connections with, like, the art buyers in Europe. She holds art exhibitions. She starts releasing some of Vincent's letters, which, like, builds up interest until, you know, everybody starts to acknowledge this work is valuable. Sometimes we can't see what our legacies will be. You know, because we tend to think very short term. And yet, in this passage in Isaiah, it says, put your hope in God. Wait on God. God's plans are bigger than you. You only see in the short term, but God can see in the long term. So trust in him. And that's the last message that God gives to Isaiah here as well. Isaiah 8, verse 19. When someone tells you to consult mediums and spiritists who whisper and mutter, should not a people inquire of their God? Why consult the dead on behalf of the living? Consult God's instruction and the testimony of warning. If anyone does not speak according to this word, they have no light of dawn. The last thing God offers is to be a guide. So when you are feeling like you're rejected or when you're just going through a hard time, God's like, why go to the dead? Don't consult the dead. You can come to the living God. I will be your guide. I'll be like a dawn, like the dawn light in the darkness. Come to me. And in fact, this is why God raises Isaiah up to be a guide. These words are given to guide people in the darkest of times. And so God says, turn to me, whether that's the community or Isaiah, to put their faith in God. In some ways, I think of Vincent van Gogh as, and I think a lot of artists can have this, as having a prophetic aspect, because I think they do guide us and point us, and particularly Vincent's work, I think, points us to the gospel. And one of the things that kind of influenced Vincent was Isaiah, particularly Isaiah 53, which is the chapter about the suffering servant, which we normally think of Jesus. But Vincent saw and found comfort in these words that spoke about suffering, and that he thought, okay, part of what it is to love, part of what it is to follow God is to experience some form of suffering. And so he really leaned into this idea that even though he'd gone through this darkness of rejection and failure, that something new was going to open up in him and the work that he was doing. And that's the gospel, isn't it? Like when we think about Jesus, we think about a man who came to guide people, but was rejected by his community, who was sustained by God through prayer, and he had his disciples as well, but died in obscurity. He died a shameful death on the cross, He died rejected by his community, and yet we say something new cracks open here, that there is something new being done in him. There's this resurrection. That's our story. And so I don't know if anybody ever feels like they're sitting with rejection, but part of the story that we say as Christians is that rejection is not the end. That actually something new might be cracking open, that God might be leading you to be a counter voice. As Christians, we take comfort in the hope that there is a longer future, that resurrection is our end point. And as Christians, we hear this invitation to discover that God is our guide and our sanctuary wherever we might find ourselves. And so we take comfort and we ask the God's Spirit to continue to do the work of healing and transformation that is needed. So let me pray for us that that might be so. Heavenly Father, I thank you so much that you meet us where we are, that you know what wounds that we carry. God, today I don't know if this is anyone's story, but I pray for anyone who feels like they don't quite fit in or not sure where they belong, or who sometimes feel like they're rejected or carry the hurt of rejection. God, I pray that you might be their comfort and strength and hope. God, I pray that your Spirit might heal and transform us. Help us to listen to your voice and help us to be a counter voice in the world around us, God. May we point to the good news of Jesus Christ and how we live and how we speak and how we love. We commit ourselves to you. Amen.